I don't just want to beat the statistic. I want to knock it out of the park. I don't want to just have a company. I want the biggest company. I want to just show everybody like what's possible. It's not just a financial thing. It's a hope thing. Like you can come from the depths of misery to the top pinnacle of success.
You're listening to What Fuels You, where we deep dive with CEOs, entrepreneurs, and business leaders to learn more about their stories and uncover nuggets of wisdom we can all use. I'm your host, Shauna Swerland, CEO of Fuel Talent, an award-winning recruiting firm based in Seattle. Today's guest on the What Fuels You podcast is Mike Powers. Mike is the founder and president of Alliance Partition Systems. With over 20 years of experience in the industry, Mike has done everything from scrapping at Safeco Field as a first bracket apprentice to successfully bidding and managing multi-million dollar projects as an estimator and project manager to president of one of the largest drywall companies in the state. He has three children, two teenage girls and a tween boy. He enjoys spending time with the kids and traveling. His goal is to keep APS rated as the best place to work in the industry and as a result, become the largest drywaller in Washington and Oregon. Mike founded this company in September 2007. So welcome, Mike. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So I'm first hitting you with some rapid fire. I know you're a fellow hip-hop fan, so are you? And you're younger than me, but Tupac or Biggie?
Definitely Tupac.
West Coast. Definitely Tupac. Okay.
I love some Biggie, but the All Eyes on Me double CD soundtrack, I mean, come on.
I know.
One of the best of all time.
I agree. And I'm very proud. All three of my kids love hip hop, so that's good. Have you been able to impart your wisdom, your music wisdom on your kids?
No, my kids think that I must just listen to a bunch of old folk music and have no idea about what music really is. They think only good music is the new music.
Oh, it's like, no, totally disagree. Okay, tell me, I know you're a traveler and that you've done a ton of travel through EO. What has been your favorite country so far that you've visited?
Oh, wow. That's fragmented. I'm going to give you a fragmented answer because there's different categories for food, because I'm a total foodie. Hands down, Vietnam was the best food experience I've had. I love all the fresh lemongrass and the soups and stuff in Vietnam. Culturally, I would say the Philippines. The people there are just super, super hospitable and kind and nice and just a very good culture. I'm not a big city person, but my favorite city has been Tokyo. I don't know what they're doing there and how they're doing it, but there's no homeless, there's no crime, there's no graffiti, there's no garbage. It's just such a clean city. Really loved that.
Well, a lot of it has to do with their schooling. I just heard this recently, like the kids up until like, I think, fourth grade, maybe they have no grades, and a lot of the things that they learn are about like humanitarian efforts or like just being a good person. I saw this, of course, on like, you know, Instagram or something, but they put together this video, and apparently they learn about like how to have respect for others, how to clean up your space, and then they don't have janitors and stuff in the schools. The kids clean the schools. So it's like respect for humans, respect for space. Anyway, love Tokyo also. And I'm going to Vietnam next week. So we need to talk offline. Yes.
Yeah. Well, whatever they're doing in Tokyo, we should R&D it. I don't mean research and development. I mean, rip off and duplicate.
I agree. 100%. Okay. Here's another question for you. Do you have a nickname or are there several? And what's your favorite?
Oh, I'm pretty boring in that category. It's My name is Michael, but the only one who calls me Michael is my mom. And if you throw a middle and a last name to it, that defines the category of how in trouble I am. Everybody else just calls me Mike.
No Mikey, no Mikester, Mikey no. G, no, none of those. Just Mike.
Well, right. Okay. So there is one. Lindsay will get a kick
There's
out of
this. There's got to be something.
So I sent Lindsay a screenshot of a text I had with my 16-year-old daughter. And her friends dubbed me OG Gangsta Mike, which
right, I don't know why. So they get it.
They were just being funny. But I sent that to Lindsay and said, this is how my conversations go with my 16-year-old. And now Lindsay has held on to that and is calling me OG Gangsta Mike.
Oh yeah, OG Gangsta Mike. So since you're a foodie, what would be your like last supper, last meal, favorite food?
I would probably go for some delicious fresh sushi or sashimi with a beautiful bowl of either some ramen or some pho soup, and maybe a side of some pad thai. Obviously anything Asian. I love Asian
Yeah, I
food.
was gonna say you're going towards the Asian food. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a person, Mike, that you most admire or has most influenced you?
That's a harder one. Jesus Christ is what pops to mind as somebody that I admire and look up to as a role model. We really moved as a kid. It was just my mom and my sister, and we moved like every 6 months. So I didn't really have, that's probably one of the things I was missing growing up was a male role model or somebody to look up to. That was something that's always kind of absent in my life. No, and I think maybe a role model could have been limiting as well as encouraging as far as what you can or can't accomplish. I didn't have a role model to limit any beliefs, so I kind of thought I could do everything.
I like that. That's great. Okay, final question, and then we're going to get into it. I don't know if you watch TV, so I'm just going to throw it all out there. What are you listening to or watching or reading that you want to share that you're into right now?
I have a horrible habit because I know every podcast I watch about light tells me I should not watch the screen before bed. But my habit is every night before I go to bed, I watch one episode of whatever show I'm watching. And when I go to the gym, when I'm doing cardio, I watch a show. So I find a show that thoroughly intrigues me, and then I will stay loyal to that show and I will only watch that. And so currently, right now, I'm watching Witcher. Which is similar to one of my all-time favorites, which is Game of Thrones. Witcher's different but similar. And other than that, Friday Night Lights has been one of my all-time favorites. The seven series, not there's a movie too, but there is a seven season series, and Sopranos was one of my favorites.
I think that's a good idea, though, what you're saying, that you will limit yourself to watch one episode because sometimes I get in and I'll just start binging. And then I'm like, okay, maybe my rule should be that I'm like on the bike or doing something cardio wise. So I'm like multitasking something healthy while I'm doing it. I love that you're doing that. I don't know you that well, but I do know a lot of people, like you have a lot of admirers. And I think that you have an ability to make people feel really warm and connected. I think you're just like, that's so cliche, but like really good with people. And I'm curious where that comes from. Like, have you always been like that, or is that like a skill that you developed? There's a lot of people that I'm like, extrovert or introvert, and I'm assuming they're an extrovert. They're like, I'm a total introvert, but I'm trained to be an extrovert because I have to be, or something like that.
Yeah, I think as far as introvert extrovert, I think I'm an introvert that's really good at faking it and being extroverted. But I definitely recharge my batteries by having some downtime alone. I think one of the so we all got different gifts, just a matter whatever you believe, whether it's just genetics or gifts given from God, whatever it is, we all have different gifts. And like you could put a gun to my head and I couldn't draw you a picture of a dog to save my life, but I can coordinate large numbers of people and know like who's doing what and where. But even more so on a one-on-one basis with our customers and day-to-day dealings, I think I have the ability to figure out like what the other person is looking for, like what they want out of this relationship or this conversation or this transaction. And I try to make myself that. So it's you know, instead of figuring out what, you know, what do I want, what it's like, what do they want, and how can I use that to leverage to get to what we need for the company ultimately. But yeah, I think one of the gifts I was given, I think, is a sense for how the other person is feeling. Am I offending them? Am I making them feel good? Are they feeling down? Do they need a boost? Do they need a pick me up? Do they need an encouragement? Or sometimes they're just flat rude people, and those are the ones I struggle the most with, like the people that just want to spread negativity and be miserable. There's not, I can get along with most people, but there's that 1 in 100 that's just like,
yeah, it's crazy. Cause I was at a concert last week and this guy, you know, he's like, a guy walks up and he's like, guys, don't you think anybody else wants to see this concert? We are standing. And we were kind of like, we're at a freaking concert. Like, really? But my inclination was to offer him the spot next to me that was open, like, so he could be closer. Mm-hmm. And all the people near me were like, can I tell him to beat it? But I was just like, he was so angry. His energy was so angry. And it wasn't that type of concert. It was like actually a healing, really warm, loving, you know, artist. And it's just interesting that you say that, because like it is so difficult to deal with people that are just, you just have to imagine that they might just be having like a horrible day, or that maybe they are just jerks, but I generally like believe like people are good. And then I go toward like, something must be wrong. Like something must have happened.
I agree with that. Yeah. I think people are perpetually good by nature. And I like to make people happy in any transaction I have with them. I like to make people feel good. But there's some people that are just, are just not going to be happy. They're just not happy people. And I think that is something that's happened in their life or has nothing to do with me or you. It's just who they are and you can't affect it. And just try to keep your own positive energy and stay away from it.
Yeah. I love that. I want to get into your company and some of your company values. I loved what you wrote and thought it was great, but let's first start with like you before the company. So you mentioned your mom and your sister and that you moved often. Where would you call yourself from?
So we moved a lot. Some of it was, my dad died when I was 3. And so it was really, after he died, she didn't want to stay in the house where he passed away. So we moved, and then it was a series of, didn't like it there, got kicked out, couldn't pay rent, or I got us kicked out as a teenager for being stupid. So
you are not, you are a naughty teenager.
Yeah. I got in a lot of trouble when I was younger. I think I had to do everything wrong before I do it right.
You got to get to it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. So we moved a lot. I think altogether, I mean, I didn't finish high school, and I went to 17 different schools roughly, and I only made it through 10th grade. So that kind of gives you an idea of how often we moved. But yeah, it was just me, my mom, and my sister. And then my sister, when I was 9, she had a major medical issue with an aneurysm in her brain that she almost didn't survive. And it created a paralysis in the left side of her body. And so that was a big focus of our lives for quite a few years of all of her surgeries and being in the hospital with her. So
how is she doing now?
She's still paralyzed on the left side of her body. She was 17 and pregnant when it happened. Baby lived and was as healthy and fine. She's had a couple more aneurysms. She has seizures a lot. Every few months she gets brought to the hospital with the grand mal. So she's struggling.
A lot to go through. And is your mom still alive?
My mom's still alive. She's also had a lot of medical issues. She did a very poor job of taking care of herself physically through life. So she was living with me when she developed spinal stenosis, which is a degeneration in her back, and she started having falls and needing more help. And so she ended up, we tried to find a lot of different places. We found these really high-end retirement centers, which she didn't like. We tried a smaller adult family home where it was just a few. She got herself kicked out of there. She's very vocal. She's Italian. She's very, she doesn't pull any punches. We ended up finding a place called Arlington Health and Rehab where the people there are just amazing and nice and treat her very, very well. She actually likes it there. And I try to pick her up at least once a week. I shoot for twice a week to get her out of there and bring her to my house. And I think that helps a lot with her mental health.
Amazing.
She's got some dementia and early onset Alzheimer's and is in a wheelchair now.
That's a lot on you. It sounds like you're kind of a caregiver, caretaker by nature, but also out of necessity. And I'm curious how that has influenced your like leadership style. I mean, I'm guessing that that's just kind of in your DNA, just listening to you talk.
Yeah, if anything, it probably has negatively impacted my business acumen, because I make a lot of decisions that aren't the best financial decisions. They're just the best people decisions, and that definitely has bled into my company. And it worked really well when times were good to be able to be proud of the fact that we make people decisions over profit decisions. As things get harder, it's definitely harder to maintain onto that when the economy changes and things get rough and you're having to make more calculated decisions that goes against the grain, that creates a conflict there. But yeah, with the
That resonates for me. I totally get that. I completely get that. It's really, really hard. And I think that there's this feeling when I see leaders who are super disciplined around kind of profit. I think you can obviously be both. But when I see people be very disciplined, you know, looking at the P&L and the balance sheet and focusing on that, I am like, what is the deal with me that I care so deeply about? Not just that are people okay, but I think there is a certain aspect of it is like, I want them to love me. You know, like it's a lot of that too, beyond just are they okay, which is altruistic and lovely, but it's also what if they're mad at me and what if I hurt somebody, or offend somebody? It's hard to get that kind of perfect balance just right. And so what was your mom doing to support you guys when you were little? I know you said you didn't really have kind of somebody influencing you that you looked up to. Where does this kind of drive come from for you?
she was, I mean, she was thrifty. She made it as a single mom. She got Social Security after my dad passed, which now I realize it was $1,200 a month, today's dollars. So it wasn't a lot of money. She worked as a telemarketer, which was one of my first jobs. I got a job doing it, and at the time, minimum wage was 7 an hour, and I got paid 9 an hour working there. And then you get a $25 commission every time you get somebody to show up for the sales pitch. So that's what she did for a living. So she didn't make a lot of money doing it, but she was able to leverage a lot of stuff from the state. So we got in low-income housing, and we were able to get food stamps and then Quest cards when they switched over to Quest cards. So yeah, she was always thrifty and used the resources that were available to her. And even in that, we never, like, she was able to find low-income housing in Woodinville and Redmond. And so, I mean, nice areas. I didn't grow up in, in projects and, like, in the hard areas of Seattle or anything like that. We grew up in crappy parts of nice areas, if that
Yeah.
makes sense, right?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And so, are you still in touch with some of your childhood friends? And if so, would they be surprised to see what you've made of your life? Or is this like, oh, that was always Mike?
No, very surprised.
Because when you say you were like naughty, were you like, what was your, I'm sure you've done some soul searching or maybe even therapy about this, but like, what was driving that at the time? Or do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, actually, I've reflected on that a little bit, on why did I make so many stupid choices? Because, like, just to kind of sum the extent of the stupid choices, I started getting arrested at 13 years old, and I got some shoplifting charges, and then minor in consumption of alcohol, an assault charge for a fight, taking a motor vehicle. These are all just as juveniles. It got worse as an adult. So a lot of really, really bad choices. I was using drugs regularly, started with just smoking pot. And then the motto when I was smoking pot was I would outsmoke anybody. And so I would challenge anyone. Like, I it was a pride thing, or my, whatever you call it, I would outsmoke anybody. And so it was, and then as that moved into acid and mushrooms and methamphetamines and different drugs, it was always just this motto of I'm down for anything. I won't
Yeah,
say
I'm go
no.
big or go home. Look at me, I'm so tough, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so. It was like this inability to say no. Like, if somebody wanted to go do something crazy, it was always, my motto was just always a yes. And that's, maybe that's part of entrepreneurship, of needing to be a risk taker at an extreme level. Maybe that mentality showing up at a young age, but there was, I mean, stupid choices. Like, yeah, it's a good idea to go jump off that cliff. Let's do it. Or, yeah, it's a good idea to go try to steal somebody's car in the middle of the night. Let's do it. Like, it was just, not that I thought it was a good idea. I just didn't care, which is.
Do you think that you were like a good kid in the wrong crowd, or were you the wrong crowd that other kids were like, other parents would be like, yeah, if Mike's going to be there, probably. Mm-hmm. Because you've got such, I mean, I'm guessing, because we all have these friends, right? We all have these kids in our class. And I'm guessing that maybe your success might be like potentially a surprise to some of those kids, because you just kind of like, I want to hear how you got where you are. But I'm guessing you were also really cool and kind and sweet, because people don't really change that much.
Yeah, I don't think I didn't have like this big bad boy reputation. Like, I was always nice and polite. Parents liked me, got along good. The interesting part, what I thought of when you were saying that, is if I rewind the clock even a little bit more, through elementary school, when you moved a lot, I was a total dork. Like, if I go back to the pictures, I had a mullet, I wore thick glasses, I was a nerd in school because I was always really good at the schoolwork without really trying. I socially struggled, and I was academically gifted. I could get really
well. That makes sense that you'd want to go steal a car, do whatever, if like the cool kids are asking you to do it, and you're trying to fit in. You don't want to disappoint. So you want to be loved.
You're hitting the nail on the head. And where it actually started was, so I didn't have a lot of friends. I moved a lot. I remember even at recess in elementary school, I'd go sit in the library. I was a total dork. But when I started, my mom smoked cigarettes, and I started, around 12, 13, smoking her cigarettes. And then I started stealing them from the store, which is a terrible habit. I was, from a young age, we didn't have any money, but I could go, we lived behind Albertsons in Winville, and I could go into Albertsons and steal donuts and stuff for breakfast, which is like, I can't believe I'm admitting that on a podcast, but that was a really bad habit from a young age. But I started stealing cigarettes, and then I found I could steal cigarettes and I could sell them. And all of a sudden, this group of kids liked me. I had something that they wanted, and they wanted.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So then I started stealing more cigarettes. And then I was known in Redmond as being like the kid that sold cigarettes. And I worked at Safeway, and I could actually steal quantities of cigarettes, and I was selling them for a buck a pack. I got fired.
Yeah, you probably could have gotten $2 a pack. I'm just kidding.
Probably could have. But all of a sudden,
I'm kidding.
A dollar a pack was a heck of a deal. But all of a sudden I had people wanting to talk to me and people being around me. And I think I liked that feeling. That social was something I missed. Granted, I was getting it in the wrong way, and I was getting it from the wrong people. But then that ability to that will never say no mentality also seemed to aid in my social struggles of trying to find friends. So I always had a few friends that I got along with really good and was with all the time. So I'd have a few really good friends, and rather than a lot of associates, I always had a few good best friends, and I still keep in contact. Some of them just through Facebook, but still keep in contact with a lot of them.
Yeah. So you're saying like they would be surprised, because you ultimately, obviously, what was the turning point that made you be like, okay, I'm done kind of getting in trouble and going to jail? And then also, you said you stopped high school in 10th grade. Did you ever go back and get a GED, or have you, like, where was this turning point for you?
I got my GED when I was in juvenile detention. That's the extent of my education. I'll just give a sneak peek forward. I just finished our financials last year, and it was a tough year on the bottom line, but on the top line, we did $55 million in sales. So I have a very successful company today. So, but at the time, I got my GED in juvenile detention. And I think if you would have asked my friends at the time, I probably would have won the award for most likely to go to prison. And they actually would have got that accurate, because at 18, I did get arrested for selling methamphetamines, and I got a 41-month prison sentence. So at 18, I went to prison for the first time for 41 months. And I served 36 of it, got some good time, got out early.
Can you tell me? I think I've had someone else on the podcast that has been in jail. I've definitely had a few people that have overcome, life choices that have put them in trouble and then kind of got on the right path. But what was your experience like in jail? Like, was it scary? Was it productive? Was it segregated like in the movies?
Oh, it's great. It's a great question. So it is like the movies in that it's segregated. It's very, very racial, and it's the worst of every race. And you have to be the cliche of what that is and what that means. But yeah, at 18 going in, I was very scared. I didn't know quite what to do or how to act. Again, I never had a male role model, and I think I was always intimidated hanging around with other guys or other men. I grew up with mom and sister, so I always felt kind of inadequate there. And so when I went in at 18, I went in scared, and that just meant that I felt like I needed to prove something. So I ended up getting in quite a few fights early on, and I would get kicked out. I went to minimum security, then I got kicked out, went to medium security, and so I didn't quite know how to deal with it. But eventually, just to flash forward a minute, I was only out for 6 months and got really bad on other drugs, and I went back for another 54-month sentence. So ultimately, I ended up serving about 8 years altogether. And after the first probably 2 years, I really figured it out of what it's like in there. And actually, when you're in there and everybody's clean and sober and off of drugs, because there's some drugs in there, not a lot, not enough to like maintain a habit like you do on the streets. But there's actually some really good, talented people in there, some artists and just creative, like risk-taking minds, and you make really good friends in there. And so if you have, I mean, as long as you're not in there for, it is like the movies that child molesters and rapists are not treated well in there. So as long as you have clean paperwork, you don't have any weird crimes on your record, and you've got a decent social game, it's actually really easy in prison. You get a TV, you get to work out every day, you go out to the big yard, you play pinochle and dominoes all day, you get a group of friends, they cook your food for you, they do your laundry for you. Ultimately, prison is super, super easy. That's why 90% of the people that get out go back for a second. It's 74% of people who go to prison once go to prison twice. And then if you've been to prison twice, 90% of the people go a third time.
This is the statistic I was waiting for, and I'm so happy you know it because I was in my head like, you are even more of an anomaly twice, like 90%. So you're in the 10% that doesn't.
It is a revolving door in there. You see the same people. They get out, they come back, and you often make a joke about it, like, see you soon.
And did you have people in your life that were coming to visit you, or did your friends kind of abandon you?
So the first time I went in, a lot of people wrote and kept in touch, and I got visits. I was only out for 6 months, and I didn't see very many of them. I just went right back on drugs. And so the second time I went back, I didn't even really reach out to anybody. And so no pen pals the second time, no visits the second time. And I actually preferred it that way. It's easier that way. Visits and letters from the streets, that just makes you think about the streets, and it makes you miss it. If you can just fully like put that out of your mind and be present with where you're at, where your time goes by much, much easier.
And what were you addicted to?
When I went the first time, it was methamphetamines. I was using meth intravenously, and so right now I'm right around 200 pounds. When they arrested me at 18, I've got a picture I should give you to put up here. Anyway, at 18, I was 138 pounds, totally strung out on meth. I was shooting about an 8 ball a day, roughly. And then when I did that a little over 3 years, when I got out, the method changed. Like everybody all of a sudden was cooking this lithium, and it was different. Or maybe I had changed, but I tried the meth again, and it just didn't do what it used to do. And so I ended up finding that I liked speedballs, which is where you cook some heroin and you put coke in with it, and then you shoot that up. And that is like the mind-blowing, hearing helicopters, knees knocking together, blow your mind high. And so the problem with that is if you do those every day, eventually you become addicted to the heroin, and then it's an addiction. So the pro like if
I mean, I can't believe that you're sober and that you're running the, I mean, you really are. It's a miracle. I mean, it's incredible. How did you get sober?
So, the the problem with drugs, if it could sh if I showed it on a graph, like the first time you do it, you have this huge peak where it's the best feeling you've ever experienced in your life. And you'll very rarely find anybody say that they did it once. Like you do it again,
Well, yeah, because you want that feeling again.
you want to get
Yeah.
back there. But the problem is once you go up this high, you have an opposite or equal reaction. So then you go down below the line. And then the next time you do it, you do the same amount or even more, but you don't quite get to that same place. And then you drop further. And then you go up not quite the same, and you drop further. And that up and down keeps going to where eventually you're not even getting to the baseline. You can't even do enough just to stay normal. Like you're not even feeling good anymore. You're just trying to be normal. And then when you don't have any, that low that you drop to is a low that most people that haven't experienced it can't understand. It's worse than hopeless. It's worse than depression. It's worse than mental illness. It's complete and utter misery. It's to the point where like you'd rather die than feel that feeling. So going sober isn't an option. Like you just got to get back to normal. So the problem is breaking that cycle and being able to find a way out of it. Prison is one way. For me, I did so many drugs, I think I broke my brain to where it wasn't fun anymore. As soon as I would do cocaine, I became that person that was paranoid, looking out windows, watching the mirror. I'm being followed. You're working for the cops. Like I'm just not fun to be around. I don't like myself on it. So fortunately, like that feeling good went away. It doesn't feel good. I'm so far below the line at this point, having done so many drugs. Like as soon as I do it, I don't go up. I just drop back down to where I left off because it picks right back up where you left off. It doesn't get good again. It
It
picks up
doesn't
right.
help to do more and more and more. Like in my mind, I'm going, oh, well, you just double your dose.
It gets worse and worse and worse. You just
Yeah.
drop further and further and further down under the line. And you can't explain that to anybody who's just starting to do drugs because they have that peak up here, that life is perfect. I want this feeling. This is what I live for. But yeah, you get to where it's just utter and complete hell.
So how did you break the cycle?
Switched addictions. Ironically, last time I got out of jail in 2002, I had no intention of doing good. I was figuring I would just try to make it last outside as long as I could, and I'd end up back. I'd even told people as I'm leaving, I'll save me a bed, I'll see you soon. But when I released, what was unique on that trip is my mom finally cut me off. She said, "You can't come here," which created some challenges because you have to have an address to get released to. So when my mom said no, I didn't have a way to get released. So my release date was actually in May of 2002, but I didn't have an approved address. So May went by, June, July, August, I'm still in jail. The only way you can get out, if you don't have somebody's house to go to, is you can prepay at a shelter for 2 weeks. There's two in Seattle, the William Booth Center and the Aloha House, William Booth Center in Chinatown and the Aloha House on Aurora. And either of those shelters for $70 a week in 2002, I don't know what it is now, that guarantees you a bed for a week. A bed is free, but to guarantee a bed, it's $70. And if you can pay them $140, that guarantees you a bed for 2 weeks. That's enough to get released. So I needed $140, but I make 16 cents an hour. My mom didn't tell me that until a couple months before I got out. So I had to save all my money and not buy commissary and get to $140 and then send it. And then they take their sweet time. It takes another 60 to 90 days for them to approve the address. They have to go out and look at it, approve it. And so finally my address got approved on September 4th of 02, and they sent me on a Greyhound bus to Seattle with my state property, $40 gate money, and 2 weeks at a shelter. And it was really going to that shelter that changed things. The shelter, the William Booth Center in Seattle, while I'm sure takes a lot of homeless people out of the cold and does a lot of good things, it is the pits of hell. It is absolute misery in there. Way worse than prison. The mental illness, the screams in the middle of the night, the moans, the mattresses that smelled like pee and vomit. Like it's just a horrible place. Walking through, people lined up on the curbs on both sides and walking through plumes of crack smoke on your way inside. It's just not a good place to live. So I wanted out of there really bad. And so I had just started an apprenticeship program those 6 months I was out. previously, and I picked that up and I went to work the next day doing steel stud framing and drywall in the union as a second bracket apprentice, and wanted to get out of that place so bad. I just begged like any overtime, any side jobs, anything to get me out of here. And so I found two things out. One, I found out that when I was sober, I was really good at framing and drywall, and that two, people wanted me and they liked me at the job site because I would show up there early and I'd stay late. Mainly because I didn't want to be at that place, but for whatever reason. And so I started
you hit your rock bottom, right? Yeah. I mean, that was your rock bottom. You needed to hit rock bottom to be like, I got to get out of here.
Yeah. And then I think finding the pride of something that I'm good at, that was like this glimmer of hope for a future of something, which is something I never had before, but it was something I was good at, and it was something that could make good money and do something with in the future. And so I enjoyed it. Like I enjoyed going there and showing, and there was a bravado to it of like, I'd challenge people that I could frame more than you and I'll hang more sheets today than you. And so I just went from being addicted to drugs to being addicted to work. And so all I did was work. I worked my 8-hour job. I worked side jobs at night. I worked side jobs on the weekends. I got, again, blessed by being put on a job, which was the Pottery Barn Kids and the Pottery Barn in New Village, that they kept changing their mind about what they wanted, but they wouldn't stop change the date of when they were going to open. And so we were working 6/10s on that job to try to get it open by, I mean, we would build something. They go, no, I want it a different way. We'd tear it apart. We'd rebuild it a new way. And they go, let's try it like this. And we tear it apart and rebuild it.
Best kind of client. Just kidding.
Best kind of client. They were paying the bills. And so I was collecting all the overtime, and, it just never really stopped from there. It took me 2 months to get out of the William Booth Center, and 4 months to buy a truck, and 11 months after I got out, I bought a house. And yeah, it was one of those loans that they shouldn't have done. That was in 2004, those high-risk loans. I had a credit score of 479, 15 grand in collections, and I'd been out of prison 11 months, and they sold me a $200,000 house.
Got it done. This is just the coolest story. And so you're working for this other company, I don't know how big it was, that did the Pottery Barn deal.
PCS was the company. They were the biggest in the Northwest. They built the Space Needle. They built the Columbia Tower, the framing and the drywall. They went out of business in the recession, but yeah, they were a huge company.
Huge company. And so tell me about Alliance Partition Systems. That's your company that you started. And how did you come up with the name, and how did you fund it, and did you have partners, or like the typical questions I'd be asking, but this is obviously not a typical story, but the most badass story ever.
Well, thank you. Well, to tell you that, I'd have to tell you one more step. So there was, before Alliance, there was, there was PowerCo, and then there was Innovative Interiors. So I got to back up to that, but, really, it all started because I was working on a side job in 2004, 2 years after I got out, and I had an accident with a skill saw, and so it went across my hand this way, and it took this finger off completely, and it messed these fingers up pretty bad to where they had to take tendons out of my foot, put them in my hand, so it took 5 surgeries and a year and a half to make this hand work again, which... when I build with my hands, it really dampened my field career. All of a sudden, now I'm one-handed. And so I'm not able to do my job, which was a major, major blow to me as a person, to me as a human, to me as like my future. All this whole bright future that I saw, I couldn't pay my house payment. I actually went to the food bank in the 7 weeks after that to get food because I didn't have any money. And it was just this... I gained 50 pounds in 3 months. Like I'm still trying to lose that 50 pounds that I gained. It was a really, really dark period of like, okay, God, now what? Like now my future's over. Now what am I supposed to do? How do I start over? And so I was really angry. And it seemed like the worst thing that could ever happen to me. Ironically, I mean, looking back at it now, it turned out to be the best thing that could have ever happened to me. Because if it hadn't happened, I'd still be out swinging a hammer. I'd probably be the best armed foreman in Seattle, but I'd still be out there swinging a hammer because I loved it. I enjoyed doing it. I like building things. But after this happened and I'm working one-handed, it just doesn't work to be able to finger screws and run power tools one-handed. It doesn't, it's not realistic. So what ended up happening was I got an opportunity to volunteer for a company called Innovative Interiors. That was a smaller company that did steel studs and drywall union. And eventually I ended up getting L&I approved, even though it was a side job. It's this long roundabout. Homeowners didn't cover it because it was a work-related injury because he hired me to do work on his house. L&I denied it because it was a side job for cash. Ultimately, L&I ended up approving it. I had to get a lawyer, and L&I approved it. And then ultimately that cost went on to the homeowner's insurance, which is where it should have went on. But in that process of 2 months, there was no income, and that was a tough time. And then after it got approved, I was eligible for a retraining program through vocational services. And so I was able to use that L&I program and work for Innovative Interiors. At first, I volunteered for a few months for free, and then we got retraining approved. And so he was able to pay me minimum wage, 20 hours a week for a year. And he taught me, the owner of that company taught me estimating, project management. I was running his manpower. So I worked for him for almost 4 years. And in that 4 years, we tripled the size of the company. I was doing all of his bids. I was PMing all the work that I got. And so I learned the management side, totally different, same industry, but now I'm the one, you know, wearing a button up shirt, sitting at a desk, but still out at job sites, participating in building these buildings. So it was there that I gained the confidence that, you know, I know how to build buildings now from an estimating and management standpoint. Still didn't intend to start my own business, but I got into an argument with the owner of that company that ended poorly, with lots of insults thrown both ways, and walked away. I had just gotten married, had my first daughter, and quit my job on the spot, which was not my intention. And then sat in my truck going, "What did you just do, Mike?" I was making 70 grand a year. It was more money than I'd ever made. But I quit. And then it was my friend who owned a concrete company that encouraged me to start this company. So that was, ironically, September 4th of 2007. I was in the Department of Labor and Industries filling out a master business application, having them help me fill it out because I didn't know what any of this stuff meant. And when I got to the date box and I said, "What's the date today?" And they said September 4th. That was like a goosebump moment for me, because that was the same day I got released from prison 5 years ago. So it was 5 years to the day after I got out that I started this company.
Yeah. And so tell me about the growth. I mean, you've got such incredible multi-million dollar projects that you've worked on, 3 offices, $55 million in revenue. How has the, like, what do you attribute the growth to? Obviously good work and then referrals, but it's hard to get good talent. I looked at your website. You've got awesome people on your team. What do you attribute this success to?
Yeah. Well, it really is having the right people. A lot, and there's a lot of luck in there, and then just a lot of, you know, good fortune and blessing along the way. But I started September 4th of 2007. So not a great time to start a business. For anybody who's been in business during that time frame, they remember what happened in 2008. Where I was lucky was that I was starting right as the recession started. So I had really low overhead. I'd bought in that house I told you about. We had a barn because I had horses at the time. And I converted my barn into my tool storage area. My living room was my office. And it was just me. So it was lean and mean. We were doing, my first job was a $900 bathroom remodel. So I would bid the jobs at night and I'd go do the jobs during the day. And I did that for like the first 5 years. I was doing kind of field and office side. And so being able to start during a recession, like, one, I think teaches you grit and teaches you how hard it is to make a dollar. Like, every dollar that you earn comes by the skin of your teeth. Like, they're hard to earn at that point. We had ads out in the little nickel that will come haul your garbage with our dump trailer. Like, we were scrappy. And so I think part of it was luck. I started at a time that taught how to be frugal, and we were a lot lower overhead than a lot of our competition. And so that was an advantage. And then as we grew, it really was just about the people and having the right people. So I was fortunate along the way to come across really good people that, that were key to our success. And those have, like, there's seasons for everybody. So the first 5 years, it was my cousin, Richard, and it was me and him. I ran the office. He was in charge of our bigger jobs out in the field. And it was just me and him. What was hard for me as a business lesson, as an entrepreneur, was to realize that seasons change and seasons end. And so as my company grew, we shifted out of alignment with each other. I wanted to go union. He didn't like the union. I wanted to continue to grow. He wanted to stay small. And so even though he was near and dear to me, I wanted, my vision was different for the company, and I'm the owner. So I was able to pursue my vision, and that ended in us growing apart. And then new people came in, right? And we would,
yeah.
And so it was just, there's been, I mean, 17 years in business now. It's been a lot of different seasons and a lot of different people.
Yeah. And so can you tell me a little bit more about your business as far as union, non-union, how you make those choices?
Yeah, we started in 07 and our original name was Powerco Drywall Systems. We haven't changed any of our entity or structure types since then, but we did do a name change when we went union. Powerco, my name's Mike Powers, so Power Company. It was not very original. I don't have, you know, we talked about gifts. Creativity was never one of mine. we build things, but other people draw them. So I don't need the creative side. So Powerco Drywall Systems, and we were non-union. The goal was to be union, but union is more expensive. So we needed to get to where we could afford that. So we were Powerco Drywall Systems from 07 until 2013. And we had a great reputation, but it was associated with, do you know Powerco? Yeah, Mike Powers. It was this, to me, in my head, it was like this small company image. And we would get confused sometimes with electrical companies because Powerco. And so when we went union, I wanted a name that sounded more union-y. if that's an adjective, I don't know, we're making adjectives up, but I wanted something that sounded larger because I had this continued vision of growth. I want to be the largest drywaller in the state. So we came up with the name Alliance Partition Systems, and that was signifying really that it's not just an alliance between us and our customers, but it's an alliance between us as a company. Everybody in this company, from the guy driving the truck to the apprentice scrapping the jobs to the foreman running the jobs to the managers in the office, we are all an alliance that needs to, we all need to do our jobs well to create this business and this culture for everybody, that people want to come to work and it makes their lives better because they work here, which is our mission. So Alliance to me was significant for that culture. So we shifted our name from, we were now in 2013, we went to Powerco Drywall Systems, DBA, Alliance Partition Systems, which was a lot to fill out on every contract that we got.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What are some of the big projects that have been particularly meaningful? And have there been bids that you haven't won? And what have you learned from that?
Yeah, good question. We get about, depending on the year, our award rate is between 7 and 13%. So at 7%, we have to bid 13 jobs to get one. So we bid a lot of jobs that we don't get. We're doing some really, really cool jobs. It just keeps getting better the more that we grow, because we have continued to grow. And you have to have the resume and the assets to do jobs that are of a certain size. And so we keep pushing that envelope and getting cooler and cooler jobs. So like right now, we're building out 42 floors of the new highest building in Bellevue. It's clear on the skyline. Just look at Bellevue and look for the tallest building. That's ours. So that always has a feeling of pride for me in that. And then in downtown Seattle, we're building the new aquarium, which is a super cool building. We're losing our shorts off on the job, but it's a very unique building in that everything is round, and there's never been a building like it before. And it's so congested with stuff in there. It's been a hard job to do, but it's something that for years and years and years is going to bring joy to everybody's heart that goes to see the building, because it's very, very cool. We built a new casino in Marysville off of Fort, the Quilcita Casino, and that one, casinos have the money to spend, so they build all the fancy stuff, which is, to me, fun. Like, as somebody who likes to build, building a wall is pretty easy. Building a drop soffit that's serpentine and kicked at an angle and domed and, like, all the fun, really unique finishes, the casinos are the ones who are doing all that stuff. So the casino we built in Marysville is fun for all the finishes that went in there. It's a really cool looking
building. Yeah. Do you ever do any residential anything anymore? I know you said your first job was that bathroom. Do you do residential stuff or just commercial?
The only residential we do, because as union, you can't compete in the residential market. Residential pays piecework. And unfortunately, it's a market that still is using a lot of people that'll work for subpar wages. So as a union company, the only residential that we can compete on is if there's a multifamily building, like a mixed use building that's got a prevailing wage to it. So anything HUD housing, anything that's Davis Bacon prevailing wage. So we are doing a lot of multifamily housing buildings, but the only reason we're able to compete is because they're prevailing wage jobs.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I read authenticity, passion, leadership, your three core values. Did you come up with those on your own, or is that something that's like a whole team effort with the whole company? And how did you land on those three things?
It was a team effort, but it was organic. It was really in our growth mode as a company. Up to about 20 million in revenue, I could have my fingers in everything. And so the culture was organic. It was just created by the people that were there. As we got bigger than that, and I became more detached from different departments. We then had leaders in each department, and we had other people doing those tasks. But it's harder when you're not the founder and the owner, because a lot of the things that we would do that would create the culture were people decisions, not profit decisions. And so it's harder when somebody's a paid employee to know like what the parameters are they can do for making bad choices that that don't make any business sense, but make a lot of sense in what they do for the person. And so we would, even with our customers, we would give things away for free. We would always be working on relationship. But as my job as the owner changed from being an owner operator to being a developer of leaders, I needed to find a way to give parameters for things that were organic to me. And so the way that we did that to be able to support the growth was through coming up with core values that would try to embody what was instinctively already occurring, which is really hard to put into words and to come up with a way to write that, right? Like to verbalize.
Yeah. Yes. 100%.
Yeah. So yeah. When we created our core values, that was probably around 2014, somewhere in that range. It was to try to verbalize those things. And so we used the acronym APS, which is Alliance Partition Systems.
I saw that. Super cool.
And the most important one is relationships. So A was authentic relationships. That was our number one core value. And then P was passionate pursuit, and S is servant leadership.
Yeah, I love that. And I saw some of the testimonials on your site too. Obviously your customers are super happy with you. Do you have someone going out kind of building relationships all day and growing the business, or is it all happening through referrals, or like what's the best source for you? And I guess if anyone's listening, like what do you want them to take away if they want to refer business to you?
Yeah, so business development is a role that I hope to fill it someday. It's something that I've still held on to because I don't think anybody can represent a company as well as the founder can. I am hoping to run into the right person that I feel that can go out there and sell us and represent us well. As it is, everybody in the company is responsible for business development to some degree. That's everything from our project managers impressing the customers that we work for, to where that customer wants to use us on all their jobs moving forward, or to where our estimators are asking the right questions and showing that we're experts in our industry to the people that we're bidding to where they want us on their bid list and we bid all their jobs. And then to me, where we'll find, you know, we decided we wanted to meet Turner. And so we just put Turner in our sights and got the chance to go meet them at their office and meet their team. And now today we're doing a lot of Turner work. Selling was a similar. We've been doing a lot of selling work.
That's great.
Yeah, we're still, there's still a lot of good customers out there that we really want to meet. So our demographic of who we would want to meet would be the larger union GCs that are building a lot of the really cool high rise, high profile projects. Mm-hmm. And there's still quite a few out there that we haven't been able to crack that shell yet.
Yeah. That's awesome. I know that you've done a lot of things and have a lot of initiatives that you've implemented to make APS the best workplace. What are some of the things that matter to you? I mean, when you come up with these things, is it like, hey, what kind of company would I want to work at? Or are they employees driving a lot of that?
So our mission statement is to improve the quality of life for our workers and to improve the industry. And so we try to use that as our filter for decision-making. I mentioned before, there's been seasons and there's as of recently, the season has been very chaotic. So, a lot of growth over the last couple of years. And then this thing, I don't know if you heard of it, this thing happened called COVID. It was this pandemic. that really threw a wrinkle in our business. It really created a lot of havoc. We're still trying to recoup from that. It changed our workforce. It changed our production numbers. It's changed way more than you would imagine. It's, you know, this quiet quitting thing, this work-life balance focus. But now at the same time, the economy is shifting because the interest rates went up. And so now construction work is drying up drastically and quickly. There was a 2-year fuse in our pipeline, and that 2 years is actually this month is 2 years from when the interest rates started going up. And so the out of work list is rising every day quickly, and that's changing the mentality of the workforce. So things are changing so fast right now, it's really hard to keep up. And our culture has struggled because we've had so much growth over the last, even just the last 3 years. We've been trying to put in all this infrastructure and all these new people. And then there's all these crazy things like COVID and the economy that keep changing and shifting everything as quickly as we're trying to adjust to it. And it's a bit chaotic right now. We're slowing down significantly this year. Our sales are going to be about half. But I'm actually kind of looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to taking a deep breath and evaluating the last couple of years and going, okay, so what worked and what didn't, and how do we need to shift?
I think that's super, super smart. And you've got tools around you of, you know, your peer group and EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, and other people who can give you wisdom of, you know, shared experience of what they've done in these moments. I do think it does give you a little bit, okay, we're slower now. We can work on the business, not necessarily as much, just totally like in the business, and make you stronger. And yes, it sucks, like COVID and the market. And I agree, our business got hit also last year. But I do find that it's making us smarter and better. And quiet quitting is a real thing. Like as a recruiter, a recruiting firm, like it's tough to find people who actually want to like work. Like what happened to everybody? It's kind of nuts. Yep. So I feel you, I hear you, and I totally get it. Makes sense. How are you keeping your mental health strong? Like, what do you do outside of work? And what gets you out of bed every morning to get you kind of still motivated?
Well, if you didn't pick it up through our conversations, I have a bit of a type A personality and I can be a little obsessive when I find things that I like. So I recently have gotten involved with Boy Scouts with my son. And I found that I have a passion for hiking and camping and backpacking. And so right now it's like all I can think about. I want to go out on a trail somewhere and hike and camp. So I've been doing a lot of that. And I'm just getting into, I want to try peaking a couple summits. I have some friends, NEO, my four mates that are mountain climbers. We're looking at August to go down to California and climb Mount Whitney.
Is it Mark Sims, one of them?
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Because yeah, I have my a friend, a group of Our friends, really close friends, have done a few mountains with him. So
Mark.
he's such a great guy.
Mark's one of my best friends on the planet and definitely one of the top three humans I've ever met. I really love that guy.
He is remarkable. I would love to spend more time with him and you. Like, I don't know that I could hike with you guys, but maybe. I'm like,
Well,
maybe I'll come
I
out.
am very beginner still, so I can't keep up with Mark, or Justin Kolachuk is another avid climber. But I've gotten better than I was. I've lost some weight, so I'm doing better. I'm going to test
Yeah.
myself next weekend. We have a 28 mile hike, so we'll see how that
Ooh. Do you have a weighted vest?
I have a backpack, so I carry my backpack fully loaded, so it's my backpacking
Yeah.
gear. So I did the last. Last weekend, I did a backpacking overnight on up to Oyster Dome on Friday, and my pack was about 40 pounds. So I'm
Good for you.
this yesterday we did a training in Arlington. There's these stairs that I can't remember the name of them, but it's
Yeah. Well, I was
probably
going to say that's where people do it. They just go do the stairs with like weighted vest, and you can get in pretty sick shape doing that.
we went
Good for
we
you.
We're
That's awesome.
training for the Scout troop is training right now because we're going in June. We're going to Philmont, which is the Boy Scouts High Adventure Camp in New Mexico, and we have a 7-day backpacking trek where we're going to cover 50 miles and peak two mountains.
That's
So,
so cool, Mike. I love it.
yeah,
How old are your kids right now?
18, 16, and 13. It's my 13-year-old boy that's
Oh, so I have 19, 17, and 13. We're
Oh, you're
like
writing
right
this
in the
new
same
book.
mix. Oh,
So,
yeah, right in the thick of it.
my 18 and 16-year-old, those are my girls, and they're the ones I have all this gray hair about.
Yeah, exactly.
My 13-year-old is my boy, and so far he's easy. He's the one I'm doing scouts with and enjoying.
Boys are definitely easier. What words would you think that your kids would use to describe you?
When I first heard that some of my background was going to come out in an article and might show up on a new on a Google search, I realized they didn't know I'd been to jail. And so I had this conversation with them that was going to be this big thing in my mind. I was like prepping for it and really sweating this conversation. And I started it each individually with one-on-one with, "Would you believe me if I told you I was in jail?" And all three of them looked at me and were like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Wait, what do you think of
That's
me?
hilarious.
Why would you say yes?" Like, I thought I had this image of this square dad, but no, apparently I don't know. I guess they don't see me as square as I thought my life has been.
You don't want to be square dad. You want to be like full, flavorful, spicy dad that's, making better choices these days.
I do live a much more law-abiding life. Like I try to. I mean, I still like I got to get better about texting and driving, and I still have bad habits I need to shake. But before Boy Scouts, my passion was traveling, so I travel a lot. Like you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. But if they had to pick one word to describe me, oh, it's my kids. What would my kids look at me as? Well, each differently. My oldest daughter right now is upset with me. She didn't finish high school, and I wouldn't let her live with me for free if she didn't get back in school. And so she opted to move out and move down to Arizona with her biological mom. And so she's mad at me because I was being so mean to make her finish high school. So her word would probably not be a very friendly one right now.
Later it will be.
I hope so. It definitely hurts right now that she's not really talking
I've
to
got
me.
a good I'm going to send you a good podcast to listen
Oh,
to.
please.
Yeah. Parenting one.
My 16-year-old, I think she thinks I'm cool. Cool, it might be the word that pops to her mind. Cool. That'd be my guess. My 13-year-old son would he would probably say maybe they would say something around. They complain that I work all the time still too, or they point out that I
Workaholic.
work all the time. So workaholic maybe. I don't know. I hope it'd be good words.
Yeah, I'm sure that things could be worse than being called a workaholic. So you mentioned, Mike, that you had to kind of sit down with your kids and ask them if they would believe you that you were in jail, because if they Googled you, it would come up. Like, why has it come up for you? Like, if you Google you.
Yeah, there was in 2019, there was a boat accident. That was a really traumatic incident. It was I mentioned my first 5 years in business was me and my cousin. So me and my cousin were going fishing on opening day of halibut season in 2019. And we got into some gnarly weather in Deception Pass. We shouldn't have went out. And we ended up getting swamped by a rogue wave that sank the boat. And it was about 4:30 in the morning when the boat went in, and the water temperature was 47 degrees. And Richard didn't make it. When we hit the water, he went into shock. I got to him. He was making this moaning noise, and even though it was dark, there was moonlight, so I was able to see him. And I got over to him, and he was in shock. So he was making these moaning noises, but he was not conscious. And so I was trying to get him to wake up and doing what they do in the movies, like slap him and stuff. And he wouldn't wake up, so I tried to just keep him out of the water. Anyway, he made it about 20 minutes, and then he passed. I tried CPR, but it's really hard in the water. It just was pointless. I try a compression to hold him, and it would just push him underwater, and try a breath, and it was just foam coming out. But sorry, it's probably a little more detail than you need there. But yeah, he didn't make it, and I ended up through this whole long series of unfortunate events and just flukes of things that went wrong that day between the Coast Guard, between the Whidbey Island Fire and Rescue, just this whole series of things that didn't go right that day. I ended up floating in the water for 8 hours before I got pulled out. And so I was conscious for about six of it, and then not conscious for the last couple. But the interesting part talking about Google is if you Google how long can a person live in 47 degree water, the answers you'll get are about 60 minutes, maybe 2 or 3 hours tops before imminent death. And the fact that I was in that water in just jeans and a t-shirt and a hoodie for 8 hours before I got pulled out is really just not explainable. It's nothing. It's just a pure miracle. I don't know how I lived. I was airlifted and evac'd, and my body temperature, they put a thermometer in, and the thermometer, it's a digital thermometer. It's in the medical reports that I read it. It says it starts at 70 degrees, the reading, and all that came up on the screen was low. So it never said in the records what my body temperature was, but it was below 70, whatever it was. And so they put these tubes in my arteries through my groin that went up to my heart that slowly started warming the blood back up. And they're worried about clotting and all that good stuff. But I survived it, and I lived through it, and Richard didn't make it, and that's what the article was about.
I'm really sorry that about Richard. That's got to be, just losing somebody close to you is traumatic enough, and having a near-death experience is a whole another trauma layered on top of it. And then there's the miracle of it all. And you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, Jesus, as it created like some sort of spirituality or religion in you, or was that already there? Like, what is your takeaway from this?
It was already there. But I mean, frankly, when, the day that happened, there's a lot of my life that I need to get better at. I mean, I'm still a sinner like we all are. And there's a lot of things that, bad habits that I have that I still need to improve on. And so it was when I was in the water and I knew that, I had 30 to 60 minutes before I would die. That's what I thought when I first hit the water. And I started realizing that rescue wasn't coming, and that I was going to meet my maker in the next 60 minutes and be accountable for everything in my life. All the bad shit that I've done and all the bad shit that I was doing was right there. And of course, there's all the bargaining, and I'm sorry, and I'll never do that again. And I'll stop gambling. I won't ever look at porn again. I mean, and whatever it is. When I did survive it, and the doctors are, I mean, even the Coast Guard, when they brought me in for the survivor debrief, they like wanted proof of what time we went in the water, because they didn't believe that somebody could live in the water that long. The longest the Coast Guard in Seattle has ever seen anybody live in the Puget Sound without wetsuits on is 3 hours. Like they said, it's just not possible to live in there for 8 hours. So it's truly not, it can't be explained medically. You can't live in 47 degree water for 8 hours without dying. All the doctors say, the Coast Guard says it, it's just not feasible, but I did. And so now that feels like there's this pressure of, okay, so God saved me. Why did God save me? And that's like, there's something I'm supposed to do. That's in a conversation. There's always, well, God's got plans for you. There's something you're supposed to do. And to be honest, like that's pressure.
Even being on this podcast, who knows who's going to listen? I'm sure as hell going to promote the hell out of it, because it's like people need to hear these stories of just before the accident, who you are and who you've become, the dad that you are. And you probably, you know, we all beat ourselves up, but just what you've done for EO, and people need to hear this story. And I'm sure every single day you feel pressure, like, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to make the world better? But just being here, we need more good people in the world, and not to judge yourself, you know, for whatever it is, if you're texting and driving or whatever it is. I just think that it's incredible. And I feel like you're a gift, like for real. It's awesome.
Well, thank you.
And my ultimate question for you, and we can, I could feel like we could do this for many more hours, but I want to be mindful of your time. But my ultimate question for you is, what fuels you?
What fuels me is I don't just want to beat the statistic. I want to knock it out of the park. I don't want to just have a company. I want the biggest company. I want to be like, there's a lot of union contractors in Washington. The biggest is this big national brand called PCI. For years, we were like the seventh or eighth largest, and we've now grown to second. PCI is the biggest by not just a little bit. They're like huge, but we're coming for them. Like we get into this high rise market, which we have been, that's where they beat us. So I want to just show everybody like what's possible. You can be a total degenerate drug addict loser, and then you can be the most successful person. And if not just the state and the nation, like I don't want to limit how far it can go. I don't know. It's not just a financial thing. It's a hope thing. Like you can come from the depths of misery to the top pinnacle of success. So I want to set that example for my kids. I want to set that example for other drug addicts. I want to set that example for people that are getting out of prison where nobody will rent to them. Nobody will hire them, because everything you fill out is, have you been convicted of a felony? I still have that. It's been 25 years. I still have to say yes. I've gotten my voting rights back. I've gotten my gun rights back. I've fought for all of those things, but yeah, I want to see how far I can take it. I want to go to every country in the world. And I want that story to be able to someday use it to give hope, to help people. And I'm not good at public speaking, so I don't know how I'm going to do that yet, but I feel like that's something that I'm supposed to do, and I hope to be able to fulfill that before I die.
Thank you for listening to the What Fuels You podcast. If you'd like to check out past episodes to hear from more business leaders, go to fueltalent.com/podcast. And if you have a minute, please leave a review and rating on your favorite podcast app, or share this episode with a friend or colleague. Please share any feedback or interview suggestions for other guests by sending a message to podcast@fueltalent.com. I'm Shauna Swerland, and thanks again for listening.